follows the gypsy. But you have no right to call me a murderer. You have a right to kill me. You have a right to do that. But you have no right to judge me. It's impossible through words to describe what is necessary to those who do not know what horror means. Horror. Horror has a face, and you must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends. If they are not, then they are enemies to be feared. They are truly enemies. I remember when I was with Special Forces. It seems a thousand centuries ago. We went into a camp to inoculate some children. We left the camp after we had inoculated the children for polio. And this old man came running after us, and he was crying. He couldn't say. We went back there, and they had come and hacked off every inoculated arm. There they were in a pile of little arms. And I remember I cried, I wept like some grandmother. I wanted to tear my teeth out. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I want to remember it. I never want to forget it. I never want to forget. And then I realized, like I was shot with a diamond. A diamond bullet right through my forehead. And I thought, my God, the genius of that. The genius, the will to do that. Perfect, genuine, complete, crystalline, pure. And then I realized they were stronger than me because they could stand it. These were not monsters, these were men. Trained cadres, these men who fought with their hearts, who have families, who have children, who are filled with love, but they have the strength to do that. If I had 10 divisions of those men, then our troubles here would be over very quickly. You have to have men who are moral and at the same time who are able to utilize their primordial instincts to kill without feeling, without passion, without judgment. Because it's judgment that defeats us.
The date is July the 9th, 2015, and it's Thor's Day all day today. I'm wondering whether they're going to transfer old Dennis Mahan from Pekin, Illinois, down to Terre Haute, Indiana. Anybody that gets to Terre Haute, Indiana, that's close to me. That's about 100 miles or less. I can go visit him. So, when David Lane was put in chains and shipped out to Terre Haute. I was all excited because I was getting ready to go down and see him when they reported that they had killed him. Oh, they didn't. They didn't plead guilty or anything, but he had a bad heart, and they chained him into the plane like they do people who are suspected of being terrorists. And they racked him around and racked him around, and by the time he got to Terre Haute, he was almost dead. Don't ever forget that, boys and girls. This is the kind of people you're dealing with, and if you're ever in a position, if it's yours or theirs, do the right thing. Put them out of their misery, because these prisons are administered by sadists and psychopaths. Don't make any difference whether you're white or black or brown or yellow or what. They are homicidal maniacs, and usually the head homicidal maniac and really a war criminal is the warden. Don't ever forget it. Do not ever forget it. Well, we're still at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. That's Warsaw. How about that? 46581, and thank you for getting your donations in for the show. We're trying to make it as interesting as possible, probing into new areas to pick up new information. I think you can see already that I do go places where most do not go, and I think I dig up information that most do not necessarily think is important. But I think it's extremely important because you have to think about it. Think about it, white man. Use your head. Quit reacting. Think. Because when I send you a piece of information that I've dug out from all the areas of the internet, I do it because it's important. It is very important. Well, it's raining again. Guess what? Surprise, surprise, as Andy Griffiths would say. Surprise, surprise. yeah, it's raining, and I guess it's going to rain. I think it's supposed to let up tomorrow, maybe, but who knows? Who knows what evil lurks in the heart of nature? The shadow do. Always remember, nature can be a bitch or a great lover. And usually not too many places in between. Well, I watched my last session of Hell on Wheels last night. I think I would class that as the best Western ever put on television. In fact, probably better than most of the movies, because a movie only has to hold up for about an hour, maybe 2 hours at the most. This has to hold up for hours and hours and hours and dozens of sessions. And now they're making new shows, and they'll be coming back. But it is a tremendous, tremendous show, and the star is absolutely terrific. And it gives a pretty good view of what was going on back there when they were building the railroads and everything across the country after, and all the ramifications of the Civil War after the Civil War and all the brutality that took place and so forth. So I'm telling you, go up to Netflix and download that Hell on Wheels. There's a few things in there that, of course, you're not going to agree with. There's one mulatto Negro that has this white woman, and there's a romance there, and there's a few things like that, but you got to just sort of overlook some of the nonsense. And however, things like that happen. I mean, you know, you got to admit that things like that did happen way back then. I mean, you know, you had all kinds of white men bending down with the Asiatic Mongols, Indians, and like that, and black buffalo soldiers bedding down with Indians, and when they could, the white prostitutes in these towns and so forth. So it was all going on way back then, just not at the level it is now. You know, one thing that's sort of funny to me in the mornings. Sometimes I'll sit down for a cup of coffee and watch a little local TV. And here in the Midwest, they got a lot of hokey stuff, or at least old-fashioned stuff. Got a channel with all these old black-and-white TV shows on, and seems like almost every time I sit down, there'll be a Western on, like this morning with Steve McQueen, a series. I forget what they called his series, Bring Him Back Alive or some crap like that. And he's always killing Indians. Every time I tune one of these old Western television series that out of the 60s and the 70s even, they're killing in Mongols. And the Mongols, and surprisingly, the Mongols are trying to kill them. So they kill the Mongols instead of the dirty white man just going around shooting the Mongol Indians. So anyhow, I could watch a little bit of that a few minutes while I have a cup of coffee, and it's entertaining, that's for sure. And Steve McQueen's a bounty hunter, and he's going around with this little, actually it's like a 30-30 carbine rifle. He's got it cut down to about a 10-inch barrel and no stock on it. I think the thing is almost worthless, because you might as well just have a 44 pistol as have that thing. And but he's running around shooting up the Indians with that thing. Of course, there's no accuracy to it, but it played good for television, and I think a lot of black KKK members must have watched these shows, because they're sawing off the shotguns and sawing off the rifles and sawing off about anything they can to hide it under their coats when they go down to rob the local liquor store. Oh, incidentally, big news. This is big news. Two very famous football or basketball players. I'm not sure which, and I didn't copy down their names. They had a wonderful 4th of July. They blew off their fingers, and one blew off one finger and the other blew off two fingers, I think, and that's going to disqualify him, probably both of them, from playing football. So Mother Nature and evolution work funny tricks on people, you know. Well, let's get back into our reading of the good old days. They were terrible, man. Yeah. We're about halfway through this book. It's not that thick a book. Well, this section's about strikes, and this is the way it was way back at the turn of the last century. And quite a ways beyond that, as the unions were gaining power to sort of beat down those capitalist people that do bad things to working class people. To most people of the upper classes, crowds of angry men in shabby clothes, no matter what their cause, were always wrong. No matter that they were workers driven to the wall by practices of their employers. No matter that their families were hungry. No matter that they were infuriated by wage reductions while profits were still rising. And these were the way they treated the white men. So you know how they treated the black ones. In the face of such total blindness to legitimate grievances, violence was inevitable. Between 1881 and 1900, American labor staged 2,378 strikes involving more than 6 million workers. With few exceptions, such as the railroad walkout against Jay Gould in 1888, these strikes proved calamitous to the workers' cause. The powerful industrialists taking refuge in the respectable sanctuary, don't they always, law and order. The question is always, whose law and whose order? They controlled public opinion because they controlled the newspapers, and slandered the labor movement as a seditious form of conspiracy. Strikes were blamed on blatant anarchists, socialists, or hordes of untrained immigrants, yet unfamiliar with the institutions of the Republic, unquote. No doubt there were some ruthless agitators within the rank and file, not to speak of roughnecks who welcomed mob rule. But labor hardly needed such incitement. It was already charged to the brim by abuses and economic hardship, and it struck only as a last resort. For instance, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 was called a protest to protest a 10% cut in wages. 10% cut in wages is quite a bit. Regrettable brutalities occurred all along the line, but the men could hardly be blamed for resisting the plunder of their starvation pay. Militia bayonets forced the workers to give in. The Pullman strike had a similar origin and outcome. Pullman, who ran his company towns with the authority of a medieval lord, had instituted 5 reductions in wages between May and December of 1893. The last one amounted to almost 30%, all this notwithstanding the fact that the company had about $25 million in its coffers, with a distribution of $2.5 million in dividends for 1891. The Homestead Steel Strike of 1892 was generated by Henry Clay Frick himself, with the admitted intention of breaking the union he hated. More than 20 died in the subsequent uprising, which was crushed by 5,000 militiamen and led to the dismissal of 3,000 workers. These strikes, an observer noted, achieved nothing but heightening police power and the erection of great armories across the land, unquote. Well, what do you expect him to do? What other way did you expect him to get any privileges? To have troops ready for anarchists dare to interfere with the orderly conduct of business. You see, when I was a kid, we had a National Guard armory right here in the town I lived near. It was a big building, too, well fortified. Well, these buildings were sort of like the federal courts. They're there to guard the system, the ruling class, these different federal courts around the country. And so they had these, the National Guard armories, around in all the areas to where if the people got out of line, these militias and the National Guard could come down on them and break their strikes and things like that. So these were not National Guard setups to protect the nation and the working people from invasions from outside the country. No, they were to control the people inside the country. The attitude of the authorities towards strikers, in fact, towards any manifestation of mass disgruntlement, was exclusively punitive, and the public at large agreed with this approach. That was your good middle-class Christians. Yes, it was, middle-class Christians. Oh, that's striking. That's terrible. They got to follow the Word of God, and the Word of God is with the millionaires. Henry Ward Beecher, gentle, unctuous brother of Harriet, who had held many anti-slavery meetings in his church, said of the strikers, quote, "If the club of the policeman knocking out the brains of a rioter will answer, then well and good. But if it does not promptly meet the exigency, then bullets and bayonets, canisters, and grape constitute one remedy." So there's your great benefactor of the Negroes, who was 100% against the white labor. Napoleon was right when he said the way to deal with a mob is to exterminate it, unquote. That was Harriet Beecher Stowe and her husband. They don't talk about that when the left talk about this wonderful anti-slavery books like Uncle Tom and so forth. Next, we go to technology. Mankind's attitude towards the machine has always been ambivalent. What Edward Bellamy called the soulless machine, incapable of any motive but insatiable greed, unquote, was feared by the workers, many of whose jobs would not have existed without it. Particularly bitter were former artisans, shoemakers, hand workers in iron, wood, and stone whose crafts had been absorbed by mechanization. They felt debased working in factories at repetitive tasks as a child could perform, their fine skills exchanged for the relentless rhythm of the machine. The early trade unions, immersed in the old craftsman's philosophy, sort of like the guilds, warned workers of the day when giant robots that made human labor expendable would chase them from the factories. They watched with fear an installation of new machinery, though they did not go as far as the Luddites, the English machine smashers of the early 1800s. Countering this widespread alarm, however, was the view of several far-sighted economists that the factory system produced more good than evil, quote, that the machine does not rob of work but gives more employment, unquote, by its constant proliferation of new industries providing new jobs. The dehumanizing aspects of the assembly line are still hotly proclaimed even though it has increased workers' prosperity and leisure time. In his book, The Doomsday Syndrome, J.R. Maddox asks, quote, who now afflicted by technology would willingly settle instead for the life of a Victorian laborer? The answer could be that the machine is merely nuts and bolts. We do the dehumanizing all by ourselves. Now we go to crime. The lawlessness of the 1860s through the 1890s, wrote criminologist Cesar Lombroso, quote, is an American phenomenon with no equal to the rest of the world, unquote. Statistics of the period, if not entirely reliable, appear to substantiate his claim. In this period, the crime rate rose by 445% against a population rise of 170%. Dominating the record was, of course, the West, where the gun-happy barbarity was damned by observers, both foreign and native, for producing a great dismal swamp of civilization. The lawlessness of the cities was less romanticized, but its perils were even greater to the common citizen. New York was known as the world's center of crime. I think it still is, isn't it? Earning the title of an extravagant toll of murders, assaults, and robberies. And these were not confined to the slums that were their primary breeding ground. The business and residential areas became infested with burglars and muggers who were after the spoils richer than what their own neighborhoods offered. Each day, Leslie's Weekly observed in 1868, quote, we see ghastly records of crime. Murder seems to have run riot, and each citizen asked, who is safe? Many thoughtful citizens looked with shame and alarm on their era, and it was neither hysteria nor sensationalism that compelled the Charleston News and the Chronicle to state, murder and violence are the distinguishing marks of our civilization, unquote. Street crime. George Templeton Strong, who lived in the Gramercy Park area of New York City, noted in his diary of 1857, most of my friends are investing in revolvers and carrying them about at night. He added an account of nightly robberies that took place near his home and described the nocturnal fears of assault as a city tradition. By 1870, however, street crime had greatly increased, and with the public sense of helplessness. The suspicion of strangers that characterizes New York's personality is no quirk of fate. It developed, as did the porcupine's bristles, in a predatory environment. In Wood's Illustrated Handbook of 1872, visitors to the city were warned to beware of all who accost you on the street. A good general rule was to avoid walking late at night anywhere, except in the busiest thoroughfares. Central Park was considered unsafe after sundown, and if a stranger wished to visit a dance hall, he was urged to go armed or with a policeman. Well, that's interesting because in 1957, between 56 and 57 or so, I was in the Army on the East Coast, stationed at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, and I was going to New York almost every weekend. I really enjoyed New York City. And I began to date different women from different parts of the city. And I remember on one occasion we walked into Central Park, and it was just, the sun was just going down, and a policeman came up to us and said, "No, don't go in there after sundown. It's too dangerous." So that was in the 50s. So I think back in the days that this book is talking about is probably mainly white criminals, but there were black criminals back then too. But I think by the time the 50s rolls around, it was almost all blacks that were already into jungle fever and controlling the night at Central Park. The lack of well-lighted streets added to the danger. A threatened gas strike in 1873 alarmed New Yorkers. Quote, "Even with the streets lighted, assaults and robberies are frequent," unquote, wrote Harper's Weekly. "In total darkness, crime would hold high carnival. Every dwelling house would have to be converted into a fortress." And I think that we're gradually moving back in that direction, especially if you're looking at financial collapses and the deterioration of the empire. Street crime was a greater menace in Chicago, it never changes, where the murder rate had quadrupled in less than 20 years. Muggings were commonplace, even in daylight, and the criminals were usually tougher than in the East. George Adey recalls that in his early Chicago days or nights, he made it a rule to use the middle of the street so that no hold-up man could step from an alley and salute us with a piece of lead or an elongated canvas bag filled with sand, unquote. His reminiscences are hardly discredited by the Chicago's 1893 arrest ratio, one arrest for every 11 residents. Wow. There were 8 times more murders in Chicago than in Paris. The criminal element was not entirely professional, owing to the absence of laws against concealed weapons. Any drifter or drunk who got hold of a pistol became a menace, although his object might have been only to sneak behind a counter to rifle a till or to filch a coat from a hallway. The outcome often was bloodshed. Street crime remains a major problem in American cities, but with public awareness and increased police efficiency, there is at least reason to believe that it will not remain so. Less than 100 years ago, before the advent of telephones and squad cars, the public mood was one unflaggingly pessimistic. Juvenile delinquents. The streets of New York became a school to turn little toughs into major outlaws. Gangs proliferated during the age. The Gophers, the Dead Rabbits, the Molasses Gang, to mention a few. And the first act of pilfering to the second of burglary was as regular as a process of a schoolboy from class to class. Well, you see, nothing's really changed. I mean, except the races. The races are mostly black, and not many white gangs. Physical training, so to speak, was acquired in gang warfare or in the terrorism of a neighborhood, which the youths would usurp from the imperiousness of the lions. Some gangs would muster up into thousands before sallying forth on their mission of pillage and death. Particularly ruthless were the flashy New York Bowery Boys, whose territory no policeman would enter without a partner, and then only during the night, never at night. If the streets were schools for crime, the prisons were graduate colleges. Here, youthful offenders were thrown together with hardened criminals whose corrupting influence complimented the court's general indifference to reform. Judge Ben Lindsay recalls his assignment as a young attorney to look after two prisoners. His clients turned out to be two young boys who had been locked in a cell for 60 days with a safecracker and a horse thief, upon whom they had learned to look as great heroes. Like grown-ups, children were locked up on the slightest suspicion of misdeed. In Chicago, upwards of 10,000 young persons were arrested, clubbed, handcuffed, and jostled away without having committed any crime. Such excesses nurtured the young a disrespect for law that strengthened the inclination towards the delinquency. Police. To modern city residents, particularly those who must travel alone at night, nothing is more reassuring than the appearance of a policeman. Despite the widespread complaints about police corruption, there appears to be confidence that the cop will do his public duty. In the good old days, such confidence was largely absent. The job requirements for policemen were rudimentary. Toughness was necessary to meet the challenge from the underworld. But to enlist the bully type of aspirant, ethical deficiencies often had to be overlooked. The behavior of these cops, which ranged from minor graft-taking to covert alliances with criminals, generated public mistrust of the policemen at large. Undoubtedly, they were brave, conscientious men in the ranks, but the force's reputation was earned by the great number of police who were inclined towards brutality and always eager for a handout. Appropriately, the New York police force, or police farce, as the contemporaries called it, started with a riot. In 1857, the state legislature, convinced that the city was too corrupt to govern itself, fired all the municipal policemen who were under city jurisdiction and attempted to replace them with a new metropolitan police force under an Albany-appointed commissioner. Mayor Fernando Wood refused to surrender his authority over his men, and finally the two forces clashed in a pitched battle in front of City Hall with the help of the 7th Regiment State Guard. The state won, and Wood had to give in. However, the nature of the department changed little over the ensuing 50 years. In fact, if anything, it changed for the worse. Police appointments were political, and party considerations usually took precedence over character qualifications. Nor did public mistrust recede. Chronically undermanned and lacking the technology to respond swiftly to crime, the police became the butt of increasing criticism. People in trouble agreed, more in despair than in jest. "Our last prop is the cop," was their motto. New York's own swingers. In his enforcement of the law, the old-time cop seldom gave the impression of being an assiduous student of the Constitution. In fact, Tommy says, most cops don't know the law. They know a few laws that they use on an everyday basis, but as far as knowing much of the rest of the law, forget it. So just because they say you're guilty of something and they take you away to jail does not mean in any way that you're guilty of anything or that they can win a case against you, which grants the police only limited powers. To him, the club personifies the law, and he uses it with relish on suspects, drunks, whom he thought little of killing if they resisted arrest, even persons in orderly crowds. In fact, he used it to dispense instant justice on whomever he deemed to need of it. In 1894, Lexow Committee, its investigation of police practices, charged that the station house frequently became a form of slaughterhouse, where the prisoners purportedly under the law's protection were brutally kicked and maltreated, almost in sight of the judge presiding in the court. Rookies were reprimanded when they brought in evildoers unmarked, since it was normal procedure to give arrestees a beating so the cop would have something to show in court. Always keen to advance their cause, the police took advantage of the complete news blackout on their activities to juggle statistics and make New York appear to the world to be a low-crime area. The commissioners never informed the public about the countless assorted crimes. How many hundred things that trench powerfully on comfort transpire daily under the very noses of these guardians, which they do not see or are powerless to prevent. Conditions were similar in other cities. The police forces were not professional organizations, but political ones. And efforts to change this were futile. In Chicago, here we go with Chicago again, the Pinkerton Agency offered to take over the police at two-thirds what the city already was spending on ineffectual force, and to guarantee that the citizens would actually be protected. But nothing came of it. Could be because the actions of the Pinkertons have always been highly suspect throughout history, too, of overdoing it. But nothing came of it. The police work, with all its chances for kickbacks and protection money, was too good a business to let go. Burlesque sketches invariably presented the cop as the bully or the villain, and a search of the record indicates why. Because he was. Graft in the old days was not merely a fringe benefit for the police, it was the patrolman and the chief alike, a cardinal root value by which they measured their livelihood. At the highest level, there was a well-established bureaucracy handling payoffs received from two sources: legitimate business for the non-harassment protection racket and organized crime for protection. Graft made it possible for New York's vast criminal society to flourish and the police to profit in millions of dollars also. It was a charge rarely denied that our police captains are in collusion with the keepers of dance houses and gambling houses of every sort. They receive from these stipends larger than their yearly salaries. So what changes? What really changes, boys and girls? It changes form and shifts around, but it all stays the same. Centralized corruption. The system proved impervious to reform movements. A Society for the Prevention of Crime, founded in 1878, the year of Boss Tweed's death, had no effect until the Reverend Charles Parkhurst became its head. In 1892, Dr. Parkhurst, an intense Presbyterian minister, devoted a firebrand sermon to the Tammany-backed crime in New York, in which he denounced the politicians and, by implication, the police as a, quote, a lying, perjured, libidinous lot, unquote. Rocked by the accusations, Albany, the state capital, issued immediate denials, and the district attorney slapped a summons on Dr. Parkhurst requesting that he prove his charges. The clergyman, accompanied by a private detective, promptly went to the crime-infested red light district, where he exposed the profound depth of police corruption. The subsequent public outcry led to a bill for the investigation and was vetoed by the governor. However, 2 years later, in 1894, under the mounting public pressure, the Lexow Committee was formed. They always like to form committees. Usually nothing happens. Usually is meant to salve the bitches of the public, and then they go back to sleep. All commissions are to put you back to sleep. I remember the Kefauver Commission when I was just a little kid. I was only 12 or 13, sitting glued to the little 12-inch TV we had, watching that while the rest of the kids were out playing baseball. And then the other commissions that came about, I watched them all. Anyhow, the testimony assembled by the committee proved the fearful abuse of police power. Well, whenever you centralize power, it becomes corrupt. It's just the nature of things. It's sort of like maggots to a dead carcass. If there's a carcass laying in the field for a while, the flies come and then the maggots come. It's nature's way of cleaning things up, and when things are too corrupt and too rotten, then it has to be cleaned up hardcore, manually, physically, you know. The testimony assembled by this committee proved the fearful abuse of police power. It proved the lavish extent of graft and extorted from thousands of businesses, from pushcart to steamship company. It established that the jobs in the New York Police Department could be bought at a definite scale of prices, from $100 for a patrolman to $1,500 for a captaincy. It revealed that almost all police transactions were subject to financial appraisal. Quote, from the rookie's first involvement with the department, he was made aware of the systematic and pervasive impact of bribery, unquote. Now, recently I read to you about a man who was traveling from one state to another, and I forget what state it was, where he was arrested, illegally arrested, and they searched his Winnebago and found $140,000, and the police grabbed it, kept it. Now, under this federal law they have for taking, so you know, illicit money, maybe stolen money, maybe drug money, and then the cops can use it to buy equipment for the police department or stick it in their pockets. And that's been wide scale for generations, and they're doing it big time, and now they're trying to get now to reverse that. It never should have been in the first place. You can't trust people with that much power to handle that much money, where they can seize anything you've got. Corruption so institutionalized appears in retrospect to some what mitigate the evil of the individual. If the police could make bootblack Frank Martin cough up $100 for the exclusive franchise to clean shoes outside their own station house at 67th Street and 3rd Avenue, they could have felt no guilt. It was simply their way of life. The payoff. Prostitution. The Victorian posture was one of stern resistance to human weakness, or, as Tom would say, nature, in particular to carnal pleasures. But the business of vice was extensive enough in the cities of the 1880s to suggest that the devil was not in limbo. Respectable standards prescribed laws against prostitution in varying degrees and stringency, but these were largely unenforced, as the more urgent demands of lust and money proved irresistible. Well, of course, you know, the church lobby was the biggest deal behind that. And of course, as far as I'm concerned, the criminalization of prostitution and the non-checking out of prostitutes and so forth has led to a whole lot of this pornography and crap and crimes against women. Whereas if there was legalized prostitution and it was kept clean and kept the drugs out of it, society would be much better shape. You wouldn't have so many screwball men running around, serial killers and so forth. That's my opinion. In the larger cities such as New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and New Orleans, prostitution entrepreneurs offered services for all classes and pocketbooks, from the palatial bagnios and the brownstones to the dives in the slum areas. Well, that's nature. Man wants sex. He needs sex, and he's going to get it one way or another. It was a commercial trade practiced but with remarkable openness. The stock solicitation, quote, "Hello, dear, won't you come home with me," unquote, astounds visitors to New York, where the girls were especially brazen. Dr. Parkhurst was himself accosted there in a Water Street den by a prostitute caked with dirt, with the brashness and a Grand Central hackman ask you to have a cab. Sex had become a commodity. Well, I think sex has always been a commodity. No matter how you sell it with marriage or sell it with prostitution. sex had and you look at all these marriages, these Hollywood actors and talented people, they might as well just go steady because they get married every time they turn around. Well, that's another more cleansed form of prostitution. In fact, regular prostitution is far more honest. Sex had become a commodity, as America's first woman doctor, Elizabeth Blackwell, observed. Shrewdness and a large capital are enlisted in lawless stimulation of the mighty instinct of sex, unquote. Police protection cost the bordello operator an initiation fee of $300 to $500 and $30 to $50 monthly thereafter, traditionally collected by the precinct captain. Now, in this series on Hell on Wheels, you'll see that, of course, there was prostitution followed the railroad. And in most cases, it was set up fairly well. And if they had the right kind of person controlling the situation. The enormous number of girls involved provided an interesting counterpoint to the proclaimed rectitude of the Victorian life. In 1870, when its population was 950,000, the New York City had an estimated 10,000 prostitutes, and in 1890, the figure given by the police commissioner Burns was 40,000. You know, one question in my mind is, with all these male homosexuals just flooding this society nowadays, or at least appear to be flooding society, what would have happened if at their early ages of young boys they would have been introduced to a prostitute or women and learned how great sex was, and how many of these people would not have gravitated into homosexuality? I know, of course, they say that you're born as a homosexual. Well, that may be true in some cases, but I don't think in a large amount of these cases. And I think that probably the best thing a father can do to a young man, much better than encouraging him to go to war and join the military, is to, at an early age, take him to a clean prostitute and initial him into what sex was like and sex done properly and all that kind of stuff. That's my opinion. And if I offend you, well, that's too bad. You offend me all the time. Prostitution's unsavory side effects were often more damaging than the vice itself, as the bordellos attracted and encouraged all manner of criminals who found in them a harvest of easy victims. Of course, disease, too. You see, when I was in Amsterdam, Holland, in the military, I occasioned some prostitutes, and two or three of them became very good friends of mine. And instead of being just a hit-and-miss type situation, we used to go to the movies and to the opera and to on picnics and so forth like that. And but anyhow, in Amsterdam, every 30 days, the girls were checked by doctors, and they had to carry a card with them and produce it. And if they were caught without that card, if the card wasn't updated, they were carted off to jail. So, anyhow, let's see here. Where was I at? Where am I at here? No services reached the public without first being submitted to a thorough pilfering. Every important city job... Wait a minute. I thought I was into homosexual, and I was into prostitution. What did I do here? I guess I got excited and went all the way through prostitution, and I'm off into something else. Well, anyhow, now spoilsmen and plunderers. God, don't get me into prostitution. I get too excited. Judged even by today's practices, which are indistinguishable by virtue, politics in the good old days was thoroughly corrupt, as it is now. I add these little comments I think you notice. Criminal influences dominated government. Well, they still do. And politics became, in Ambrose Pierce's phrase, the conduct of public affairs for private advantage, as they still do. Although the federal government was mortified by an occasional scandal, yeah, right. The political corruption expressed itself most errantly at the municipal level, where scoundrels plundered quote, that fruitful and ill-fenced orchard, the city treasury, unquote. And that's why I say in any uprising in this country to change things, it's got to go all the way down to your local town. And especially, you got to clean out your state houses. Clean out the government that's closer to you. The closest to you is where most of the thievery is going on. So don't let the local con men shift your bitching all the time at the federal government, which deserves you bitching. But on the other hand, most of the robbery is taking place right in your little town and your city councils, your taxing elements of the state and the state houses. And most people overlook that. Hindsight makes it lamentably clear that the key municipal offices, rather than being forcibly seized by these manipulators, were in fact abandoned to them by decent individuals. And that's another thing, you know. The few people who are decent that want to get into government and do change are run off, or they can't even get elected. They can't even raise money to get elected. Ask me about that. Herbert Spencer saw the danger to American democracy in 1882 when he warned of the widespread acquiescence to the wrong, the readiness to permit trespassers, unquote. The professional men were too selfish to become involved, and intellectuals like Henry Adams were no match for the unconscionable bullies whose only aim was to help themselves to public funds. And that's the same way as now. Same way when I ran for office in 1882. Same way all the way up to now. It's the same thing. You're constantly fighting corruption. Okay. Let's see. Where was that? The most outstanding example of these rogues was New York City's boss, William Tweed. His political headquarters, Tammany Hall, was later described by the Reverend Parkhurst as not a party but a business enterprise like Standard Oil and Western Union. Well, now it's all combined into one. It has been estimated that during the reign of Tweed, Ring robbed the city of $160 million, and that was in 1860 and 70 dollars. Which compares favorably with the losses of the Chicago fire put at $30 million. No services reached the public without first being submitted to a thorough pilfering. Everybody along the way got their little share. Every important city job was twisted into a sinecure of some political trickster, whether it was the post of police magistrate or that of the municipal commissioner. You notice this Negro Commissioner of Police of Baltimore just got sacked. There's more behind that than meets the eye, too. You'll find that had a lot to do with corruption, and a lot of corruption among the police, and a lot of corruption at City Hall. Crespi tells of the case of the man brought back from a distant state to answer for a felony who ended up in New York as the auditor of public accounts. Favors were for sale in any department. Quote, manipulators thought no more of buying an alderman than going out and buying a watermelon, unquote. Well, they're a little more sophisticated now, but they do the same thing. Other cities during these decades were being subjected to similar boss rule. Well, we got mostly nigger rule in the cities now. The whites are so cowardly and absolutely disgustingly cowardly, they allow the niggers to take over city councils and mayorships all over the country. And then they wonder why the city goes down the tube, and then the whites out in the outlying areas have to pay for it. Nothing new. And it's just that we've replaced crooked whites in many cases with equally crooked blacks. Well, in a way you can't blame the blacks. They watch the whites and say, well, whitey's been getting away with this for hundreds of years, and now that we've got some latitude here, we're going to do the same thing. Yeah. Other cities during these decades were being subjected to similar boss rule. Chicago had its Nash machine, Boston its Lamaski spring, Kansas City had Pendergast, you know, the guy that made Harry Truman the senator, first senator and then president, directly, Pendergast, big Jew from Kansas City. And he used to have a lot of poker games. He gambled a lot there in Kansas City. From 1867 to 1920, you know, and Harry Truman was so questionable that the Ku Klux Klan wouldn't even let him into the Ku Klux Klan in Kansas City. Even though he was pretty racist. If you read a lot of the letters from Harry Truman to his wife, Bess, it's filled with anti-black stuff. From 1867 to 1922, the Cameron Quay Penrose dynasty owned Philadelphia, a city Lincoln Steffens reported was so corrupt that a man he knew, who was writing a book on the abuses that prevailed during the building of City Hall, had run out of space after three volumes. It was Steffens, too, who called St. Louis, quote, the worst governed city in the world. And it's even worse now, because it's more and more black. The bosses maintained the control of diligently currying favor with the little people, to whom they appeared as heroes from their own social class, who protected them from the tyranny of the rich and powerful. Well, in some degree, that may be true. There was always the glad hand, the free liquor, the little gifts of cash and coal, the job for new immigrant and hasty naturalization. Yeah, a lot of times these war dealers, these guys who were pretty strong and powerful politicians, did spread it around quite a bit, of course for their own interests, but they did spread it around. Every good, even Al Capone spread it around, come on. Every good man takes care of his friends, pronounced George Washington Plunkett, who fully expected that in the next election they would vote for him early and often. Such subtle pressures made reform a dirty word, and there were times when reasonable men doubted whether a majority of its residents really wanted their city to be cleansed of evil or not. The law. This sad verdict on justice was handed down by a journalist in the 1880s, and any overstatement therein appears to have been only marginal. Lower court judges were men of low caliber whose conduct of trials was influenced by their appointers, the bosses, the very elements they were supposed to control. And I've run into this, lower court judges. That's why in a trial in L.A. that I was accused of and involved in, I was being charged with a misdemeanor and I demanded to be charged with a felony. And my Jew attorney almost passed out when I said that. He said, you can't do that. You might go to state prison. I said, yeah, but I can't be tried in this lower court. I want to be tried in a higher court, superior court, so that at least some of the constitutional protections might be there, which was a great gamble for me, but I did it, and I got a lot of respect for it, and I beat it. Once the boss had interceded with the stock plea, Your Honor, I have known the boy for years. He works hard and takes care of his old mother, unquote. The young tough with a criminal record was assured to go free. It was widely believed that these same judges, merciless on the poor defendant with no friends, would never convict a rich man. That the rich could and did literally get away with murder, as they still do. In this climate, it was not surprising that the boss protected gambling and liquor, and vice operations were carried on with impunity. Large corporations tampered openly with the courts, as they still do, paying off judges and juries alike without any sense of misdeed, and they still do. As Collis P. Huntington, the man of impeccable dishonesty, put it, quote, if you have to pay money to have the right thing done, it is only just and fair to do it, unquote. It's amazing how things stay pretty much the same. Oh, there's difference in applications. They're a little bit more sophisticated, but they're even worse because they are more sophisticated. Now, I've just recorded an expose on the global warming and also on the tobacco industry. And I'm going to be putting that MP3 out, and we'll put it on our website. And I may send it out with this show, or I may send it out separately. But the one thing I wanted to remind you of course, the tobacco companies were always lying their asses off and swearing up and down tobacco was not dangerous to the health. I told you some time ago in my research, I found that, you know, everybody thinks and says Hitler was so bad. Well, he was bad in a lot of ways, but Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists did massive research on cigarettes and tobacco and had all the research put together and completed, and Hitler wouldn't even allow people to smoke around him because he knew what the results of those studies were. And at the end of the war, it was the British that commandeered that research, secreted it off to London, and hid it in the Tower of London, and it never was released. And so think of, like I said before when I talked about this, think of the millions and millions and millions of people since World War II that have died of tobacco. And then look at Hitler and say, wait a minute, you say he killed 6 million. Even if he did kill 6 million, it doesn't even pale to the knowing murder of hundreds of millions of people due to smoking. So when your friends want to argue with about it, say, okay, I'll give you the 6 million for the Jews, but you got to give me the hundreds of millions that Hitler would have saved if they'd have listened to the research that his science did. And that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow. I think I'm going to have a show tomorrow with a good friend of mine who lives in Poland. And it has a very good show, and I don't have the name of it right here before me. And that's no insult to him, because I'm traditionally forgetful. So we'll do an interview with him, and then supposedly I've got an interview with some Swedish guy and possibly a Japanese female on Saturday. We'll record them and play them for shows. And Katie Couric's secretary been calling me on and off. We keep missing each other, and she wants to do something like, when did you stop killing a Negro? When was the last time you killed a Negro? They never want to ask any important questions that have anything to do with the well-being of the country at large or anything. It's just, did you know this guy that killed these people? And I'm always tempted to say, hell yes, I had him over to breakfast a week before he did it. But I don't go quite that far. I'll see you tomorrow. 14:05. I have nothing to say, you MFers. Time is growing short, boys and girls. I don't know how short, but it's going to be short. Watch the economic indicators.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down. Being wrong, nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street singing songs and they're carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. You better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. You better stop.